Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Coming up this hour, tens of thousands of undocumented workers in New Jersey are in danger of losing their jobs because of the coronavirus pandemic. What could this mean for the local economy? Also, we'll explore the world of ornithotherapy. Birdwatching is relaxing, low or no cost, and as close as the nearest window. But to start, COVID-19 has hit many African-American communities especially hard. In Philadelphia, more people of color have died from coronavirus than whites, the rate of death over 30% higher. Data from the city also shows Black Philadelphians have been contracting the virus at an increased rate. And a recent study from Drexel University shows that people who live in Philly's wealthier neighborhoods have been tested six times more frequently than those who live in lower-income areas. As the shift in focus begins to move toward reopening sections of the economy, Democratic Congressman Dwight Evans wants to see a dramatic increase in testing for COVID-19 within the African-American community. Dwight Evans represents Pennsylvania's 3rd Congressional District. Thank you so much for being with us today. Good morning.
Thank you.
So, Congressman Evans.
Good morning to you also.
Oh, thank you. The picture is sobering. The risk of illness and death for people of color from coronavirus appears to be much higher in Philadelphia than that for whites. And yet, Congressman Evans, there has been less testing in African-American communities. What are some factors at play here?
Well, obviously, when you talk about some of the first responders, for example, individuals who work in grocery stores, individuals who may drive in our mass transit system, individuals who are out there who have to go to work and experience this virus more so than others do. And I wrote a letter, which I outlined to the governor and to the mayor, that this needs to be a priority, that it's very clear that in terms of the African-American community, that the attention needs to be brought there. And next step, I even went to the degree of calling for mandatory testing. I think that particularly in the African-American community, we need to bring that to attention. But also another step kind of came to me, whereas the majority leader of the Senate talks about appointment of judges at the federal level. We don't need that. Those are dollars that could be used, directed into the purpose of testing. Whereas he's talking about the appointment of judges, I believe that we should be focusing that money on testing. So the areas that I'm looking at is primarily three. Obviously, mandatory testing is very important. The elimination of the appointment of judges, you can reinvest that money into testing. Mm-hmm. And also, there needs to be a focus by governor and the mayor together that this needs to happen. I'm glad to hear that the governor has announced a health disparity initiative,
yes,
which I think is extremely important. Because when you begin to look at what is happening, when you talk about grocery stores, you're talking about drivers on SEPTA, you name it, workers, they are being really hit more so than anyone else. And it's been documented, as you just indicated, by the Drexel report.
Yeah. Well, and so the COVID-19 Response Task Force for Health Disparity, which is a product of the Wolf administration, calls for free and accessible testing for vulnerable populations. Dwight Evans, have you seen the state's ideas begin to materialize at the grassroots level?
Well, I think that first, by the fact that the governor raised the consciousness of it and it reached that level. Now the question is the implementation of it. And, look, I give credit to the group of Black doctors, along with the religious community and the African-American community, that is taking the lead on this. But I think you need far more than that.
Yeah.
That in itself won't solve this problem. This is a problem that is deep-seated. And when you talk about a city that has the level of poverty that we have in Philadelphia, obviously, this has to be a priority. I don't think that you can legitimately talk about reopening in the city or the state unless you find some way to address this particular issue.
Let's focus on the Black Doctors COVID-19 Consortium, which you just referenced. Dr. Ayla Stanford, surgeon, founded the consortium after a release of the report, which found that, wealthier communities were six times more likely to experience testing. You said that they were working with churches. So where are they set up, and what do you know of what they're doing on the front lines of the pandemic?
Well, I applaud a number of churches, Enon Baptist Church, Mount Carmel, Tryon Baptist Church, a few of them. And I give those ministers who have aggressively talked to their parishioners and raised the flag that they are attempting throughout. Last call, I recall the number was some in the ballpark of 1,500 to 1,800 people, and that they are on the front lines. And remember, they are voluntarily taking this action. But I also think Blue Cross, which has stepped up with their foundation and provided resources, but it's going to take more than that. And that's why I believe I raised it to the governor and to the mayor, as well as what we got to do in Washington, D.C., that this is going to have to be a national priority. This is not something that you can just do it on the side. I mean, I applaud everything they're doing, but that's why I've raised the issue as I have, because only through testing, tracing, and ultimately we got to find a vaccine.
What have you heard from Mayor Kenney?
So we can continue doing. Well, basically, his people have suggested that they was looking at the numbers, but they are using the health centers, the federal qualified health centers. But I think we need to be more aggressive than just that. I think the health centers are fine. I think the federal qualified centers, but I think we got to be far more creative. This is going to take a collective effort. This is not going to be something that can be solely by the city and the state itself. Is going to have to take far more creativity.
So you mentioned that the local churches are really reaching out to give information to the community and get folks in for testing. Do you feel then that there is enough information from public health officials about COVID-19, that information getting to communities of concern?
I think there needs to be more. I mean, I don't think we can take it lightly. I think we got to be far more aggressive. As I said to you about the statement of the majority leader of the United States Senate talking about appointment of judges, when we could take those resources and invest it into the purpose of testing. I don't think you need to be talking about the appointment of judges. I mean, you got to kind of get your priorities straight. And when he's talking about states and cities should be talking about bankruptcy, that is a mistake too. Yeah. So in my view, it's a question of priorities. Where do you invest the dollars that you have? I think that we can address public health and the economics. I don't think it's an either or.
So at
the end of the day, we got to address the public health, but we always look at the aspect of economics too.
Back to the Black Doctors COVID-19 Consortium, Dr. Ayla Stanford, I mean, right now she's helped by volunteers, but I've read that she apparently wants to be able to hire staffers to continue testing. On an immediate note, is there funding for organizations like the consortium to actually get more people involved so the testing can, the amount of testing can increase?
The answer is yes. We just voted for the last initiative, $25 billion for testing. That's across the entire United States. $11 billion of that is targeted towards the states and the locales. So of that $25 billion across the United States and $11 billion to the states, the distribution decision is determined by the governors and the mayors. So that's $11 billion. Then when you look at the effort that we are attempting to do with companies like Blue Cross and all, it's going to take that kind of collective Hercules effort to address the challenge, particularly African-American community, but across the board with our essential workers. You know, they are one and the same, and we cannot take that for granted.
Yeah.
Because if you're talking about reopening the city and the state, you have to talk about addressing the people who who are there on the front line.
Dwight Evans is a congressman representing Pennsylvania's 3rd district. And I don't know if Philadelphia's Logan neighborhood falls within the 3rd, but the point here hopefully is germane. About 84% of residents in Logan are Black. It has among the highest percentages of positive coronavirus tests. And a large number of people who live in Logan also suffer from hypertension, pulmonary disease, heart disease, diabetes, meaning they're more at risk for complications from COVID. There's also, Dwight Evans, a lack of access to doctors and preventive health care and health insurance. In your opinion, what needs to be done to shore up the health infrastructure of these neighborhoods?
Well, I think that the first thing is what we're doing here today is by having this discussion or recognition. I would argue this is not a new challenge. When you talk about health disparities, they have been there for an awful long time. But I think that clearly the recognition is the first step. The second step, as I said to you, is mandatory testing. Unless you're doing mandatory testing, I do not believe you will be appropriate to address those people in Logan. You can talk about North Philadelphia. You can talk about West Philadelphia. So I think the third thing after you talk about mandatory testing is the element of showing the collective leadership of local, state, and federal. It is that collective leadership. And then also in terms of our priorities, as I mentioned to you, we don't talk about appointing judges at the federal level when you should be investing those dollars into what the greatest need is.
Dwight Evans.
It is a question of where we invest.
We're close to wrapping up the segment, but how would mandatory testing take shape in your view? What would that involve? Requiring all adults to come in to be tested in certain neighborhoods because there's a higher incidence of the virus?
I'll give you an example. Los Angeles, 10 million people. The mayor came out, I think it was on Friday, and you can get testing done in Los Angeles. That's 10 million people. In Pennsylvania, there's 12 million people. In the city of Philadelphia, there's 1.5. So if you look at Los Angeles, the second largest city in the nation, that mayor came out with the fact that making testing available. So there's many systems, either through the PennDOT centers, there's many avenues that you can go about the business of attempting to make this matchup regarding particularly African-American community.
All right. Dwight Evans, Congressman representing Pennsylvania's 3rd District. It was a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. Up next on the Radio Times Regional Roundup, there could possibly be skyrocketing unemployment among undocumented immigrants in New Jersey. If this happens, could be a blow to the local economy. We'll hear from Brandon McCoy, president of the New Jersey Policy Perspective. And then later this hour, Ornithotherapy. We'll talk to birder Holly Merker. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The contributions made to society by undocumented immigrants often fly below the radar. But fact is, various industries would be hard put to function without the so-called invisible work of many thousands of people. It's a point thrown into high relief by the pandemic. A report just released from New Jersey Policy Perspective and Rutgers says at least 125,000 undocumented workers in New Jersey's service industry are at risk of being laid off. Potential casualties of the coronavirus's hard-hitting effect on the local economy. Who are these workers? What is their role in keeping the economy humming? And do they have access to services which will help them stay afloat until the state begins to reopen? Brandon McCoy is president of New Jersey Policy Perspective, a nonpartisan think tank promoting economic, social, and racial justice. Brandon McCoy, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm well. So undocumented workers, particularly in the service industry, Brandon, where are they generally from and what sorts of jobs are they doing?
So most of the jobs that undocumented workers in New Jersey are doing are restaurant and bar industry jobs and retail jobs. But there's also plenty of undocumented workers in sort of tax and limo service industry, personal care services, hotels and lodging. And so it's really various aspects of the service sector that is really at risk here as the economy contracts.
A great many, if not most of these jobs are low wage. What are we talking about generally in terms of compensation?
Yeah, they're not really the most well-paying jobs if you look at them. When you take into account the industries that we looked at altogether, they account for 22.9% of all jobs in New Jersey. But when you look at their wage total, they only account for 11.4% of total income in New Jersey. And so these are a lot of minimum wage jobs, low wage jobs. And the issue that we're trying to highlight here is that undocumented workers have been left out of the coronavirus relief packages passed at the federal level. And if they are also going to be making up a major portion of workforce industries that are at increased risk for contraction during the pandemic, and they don't have access to relief, then they're really in a tight spot. And that's not good for them, and it's not good for the state's economy.
So no stimulus checks, no unemployment for this group of workers?
Yes, that's correct.
And how about health insurance in general for workers doing these jobs? Non-existent, I'm guessing, or almost non-existent?
It's difficult to come by. A lot of workers will still qualify for Medicaid or Medicare, depending on their situation. And the state of New Jersey has expanded, has made a lot of investments in Medicaid expansion over the past few years and is moving towards a state health care exchange that will hopefully cover more people in the state that don't have insurance coverage. But when you look at the unemployment insurance claims that have come in over the past month, it really dwarfs anything that we've seen in the past couple of recessions. You know, the Great Recession was a really big hit to the state of New Jersey. It really took New Jersey 10 years to come back from that, really just about a year or two ago, where we're seeing average or median household income, rather, get to the level that it was in 2008. And so now we have this crisis. You have a ton of unemployment insurance claims, and you're going to have a ton of increased need for services, for relief, for SNAP and, for sort of nutrition and food stamps and things like that. And so because undocumented immigrants make up such a huge part of New Jersey, they're almost 10% of the population in New Jersey. That's an important part of the population that the state needs to focus on, because if they get hit particularly hard and they're not able to bounce back from this recession and this crisis in the way that the rest of the state is, that's just going to slow our recovery even further.
How would you characterize the potential blow to the service industry? What words come to mind if this were to come to pass?
It's hard to really put words to it. It's something that we have not seen in modern history. There's very few people living right now who have seen a pandemic like this in their lifetimes. When you look at the unemployment insurance claims, they are 4 to 5 times as bad as the Great Recession got at any point. We're going to probably pass the total number of unemployment insurance claims that took place in New Jersey for the Great Recession. We're probably going to pass that number just from this pandemic within the next week or so. Mm-hmm. And so just in the month and a half or so, we're going to really go past that Great Recession number. And so I think the concern here is both the size of this economic contraction and the speed of it is something that people didn't anticipate. A lot of people did anticipate a recession because we were at the end of a very long period of economic expansion.
Sure.
We were near 10 years of expansion. And so people figured, okay, that's probably going to end soon. But when you have the pandemic, sort of compounding the problem, things just happened much more rapidly. And I think this is a situation that a lot of people who work in government and in policy haven't seen or haven't even thought of being a situation in their professional lives.
Absolutely unprecedented. Brandon McCoy, Janice Fine of Rutgers is co-author of the study. She says the undocumented are more likely to put up with unsafe conditions in the workplace, say, a lack of coronavirus protocols, whether it's social distancing or being given face masks. Why do they put up with so much?
Because they are able to be threatened with a lot of terrible things because of their lack of documented status.
Such as?
They could be threatened with, might be threatened to call ICE on them or call ICE on their families. They could be threatened with deportation. Regardless of whether or not they are trying to move through the immigration system in the way that they are told to, a lot of folks can sort of hang immigration status over their heads if they are not doing exactly what they want them to. And so, unfortunately, a lot of undocumented workers don't have the power to speak up for themselves and protect themselves in the workplace. And that's why it's important for the state of New Jersey to implement as many protections as possible so that they cannot be taken advantage of and further marginalized than they already are.
A week and a half ago, Governor Murphy had said he'd consider a $600 a week stipend for people who lost their jobs because of the pandemic and can't receive unemployment benefits. He would not commit at the time. Do you know how this process might work? Would there be an official application process for people who are undocumented? Not sure if you have that information.
It's not entirely clear how it would work right now. I know that, some of this is driven by what we're seeing in California, and California is putting forth a similar program to support its undocumented population. But I think this points to a key situation and key difference in New Jersey is that California, heading into this crisis, had a significant rainy day fund. And while every state is going to need incredible support and relief from the federal government, states that have a significant rainy day fund are going to be able to have more flexibility to be creative and to respond to the challenges that they're facing. New Jersey comes into this crisis having a very, very small rainy day fund. In fact, we exhausted our rainy day fund under the Great Recession, and under the previous administration, the Christie administration, there was no further investment made in it. In fact, the first investment made in the rainy day fund was last year under Governor Murphy, where his administration put $400 million into the fund. That's enough to cover 1% of the state budget, just 4 days of operation, when the suggestion by state budget experts is that states try to keep about 2 months of rainy day funds on hand. And so because New Jersey did not make rainy day fund investments or savings, rather, a priority for so long, and we don't have that to be able to turn to now to help us sort of make ends meet, our ability to provide relief in the way that we would really like to is severely hampered.
Back to the potential $600 a week stipend, if indeed, the state can afford this. I was just, again, wondering about the application process and wondering whether some who are undocumented would be reluctant to go through the process for fear of exposure.
I think that's incredibly possible. Yeah, there's a lot of issues with regards to, we see it with the census where you have undocumented residents who are concerned about, participating in the census because they don't want to be tracked because of the threats that they see coming out of the federal government. Any sort of official sort of government bureaucratic system or process right now could be perceived as, a harm. And so I think the state, if it does do this sort of benefit fund, is going to have to go out of its way to make sure it's informing residents that this is not going to be used against you. This is meant to help you. This is meant to ensure that you are able to provide for yourself and your family. And that's going to require some really good public information campaign on behalf of the state.
Back to potential unsafe conditions that undocumented workers might face on the job. Are there U.S. citizens willing and able to fill those jobs?
It depends on the job you're talking about. But I think we've seen over the past several decades that, and honestly, my report author, Janice Fine, who's the director of research at the Center for Innovation and Work Organization at Rutgers, she's done a lot of research on this specific question that you're asking, which is basically that over the past several decades, because of deunionization and sort of erosion of major labor markets, You've had a lot of American citizens shift to different labor industries, right? And as immigrants have come into the country, they have taken on jobs that have fewer protections, fewer benefits, what you may have. And so this deterioration of the labor markets and working conditions can sort of be understood as just this really negative product of market forces. And a lot of the change has been sort of shaped by a combination of different management practices by the various firms. It's been shaped by really outdated employment laws, a lack of effective labor standards and enforcement of labor standards by government. And so while there may be people willing to do those jobs, because those jobs don't have the same safety precautions, yeah, labor standards, or benefits as other jobs that now exist, you know, I think you see individuals who are just happy to have employment, looking for employment, sort of looking to make it,
sure,
willing to take jobs that others would not be able to or willing to take.
Just thinking, if many undocumented workers do lose their jobs during the pandemic in New Jersey and feel a need to move elsewhere to find employment, whether, you know, how much that exacerbates the effect of all this on businesses which are left behind.
Maybe, but I don't think New Jersey is unique in the challenge it faces with this.
Sure.
I don't really think there's, you know, too many states who are going to be doing all too hot with their labor markets. And I think undocumented workers across the country are going to be facing this same challenge. I think it just really speaks to how important it is for both the federal government to act a little bit more quickly with delivering relief and support to states. And sort of, you know, it's been dragging its feet on that for a couple weeks now. But the longer that states are forced to wait for that relief, the longer they don't really have a clear picture on what they're working with. And they can't determine, you know, how to make investments or how to, you know, shape their budgets for the coming years. And also points to the need for, you know, I think a lot of people are concerned that this pandemic is highlighting all the inequities that are rife throughout our society, rife throughout our economy. And a lot of people are saying, you know, as we come out of this crisis, we need to build an economy and a society that is more equitable and stronger and more resilient than the one that we had coming into this. And so that's going to require improvements in labor law. It's going to require stronger labor protections. It's going to require better benefits and better pay. You know, a lot of the workers that we were told were undeserving of a $15 minimum wage just a couple of months ago, we're now calling them essential workers. Well, if they're so essential, then we should pay them as such, and we should give them benefits as such, right? And so this is really providing a moment of rethinking for how our systems should work. And the labor market really needs to be restructured in a way that workers have everything they need to be whole and to be safe and to make sure they can provide for themselves and their families. And undocumented workers are no different than anybody else.
A lot of work to be done. Just an enormous, almost mind-boggling amount as we come out of this. Brandon McCoy, according to New Jersey Policy Perspective, immigrants account for a full 47% of New Jersey's Main Street business owners, despite comprising, I think, 22% of the population? I forget what the figure is.
Yeah.
Characterize how immigrants, both documented and undocumented, are shaping Main Street New Jersey these days.
Oh, it's, you know, as somebody who's a Jersey boy through and through and grew up here and has never not lived in New Jersey, immigrants are a huge part of the fabric of our state, of our culture, our economy. And you walk up and down any main street in New Jersey, no matter where you are, you're going to see different types of stores, different types of restaurants, offering different types of food fare and whatever it may be, and really creating a vibrant picture of what life in New Jersey is. And I think, you know, a lot of people sort of take that for granted. People sort of just assume that that's going to be there no matter what. But immigrants are a major part of New Jersey's culture and a major part of New Jersey's economy. And you have a lot of folks who sort of treat them as other, try to marginalize them, and maybe don't realize that when you do that, you not only threaten them, but you threaten yourself and you threaten the rest of us, right? We want to make sure that everybody who lives in New Jersey is able to thrive, is able to be successful. And immigrants come to the state because they're looking for a better life and they have found success here in New Jersey. We want to make sure they can stay here and continue to be successful. So immigrants are a major part of New Jersey. It's the densest state. It's one of the most diverse states in the country. And it wouldn't be what it is without the immigrants who live here.
Well, what sort of voice does the immigrant business population have in forming immigration policy in New Jersey, Brandon?
It really depends on who's in office. But, you know, you have the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce that's very, very active. You have the African-American Chamber of Commerce, which I know a lot of people don't think of immigration as, you know, being black New Jerseyans, but a lot of black New Jerseyans are from come from other countries. Same thing with the Asian Chamber of Commerce. You have a lot of different voices and a lot of different trade associations out there doing work both at the state level and sort of the county and local level. But honestly, when you look at representation in the halls of power, and elected officials, while I would say that the Murphy administration has a very diverse cabinet and has done a pretty good job, when you look at elected officials overall, it does not reflect the diversity of the state of New Jersey. And so if we want to do a better job of that, we actually need to make sure that more people are being taken seriously, more people are being supported when they run for office, because if you consider that immigrants do make up a significant share of the state population, they're not really making up the same share those who represent the people.
And just quick note, in December, Governor Murphy signed a bill allowing immigrants, regardless of legal status, to obtain driver's licenses. I think it'll be till the end of the year before we see actual licenses issued here. But how might this help workers, both documented and undocumented, move forward?
Oh, it's going to be huge because as a society, we put so much importance on having a license, and a license really allows people to access a lot of things that they wouldn't be able to have otherwise. And so as we expect people to be able to take care of their families, take their kids to school, go grocery shopping, honestly, even just get to work, having a license is critical to being able to do all of that. And so as that is rolled out and implemented, we really hope it has a positive impact. And we have seen other states, you know, a dozen at least other states that have already done this. And we expect to see the same benefits that we've seen in those states happen here in New Jersey, where you have more immigrants being able to take a bigger part and share of the economy, do more for themselves and their families, and do so without fear of unfair and discriminatory repercussions. And so,
Brandon,
that's going to be really important.
We're out of time, unfortunately, but thanks so much for joining us. It was great.
Thank you.
Brandon McCoy is president of New Jersey Policy Perspective. And just ahead, environmental educator Holly Merker joins us to talk about the pleasures of birding and connecting to nature in this stressful time. Stay tuned. Welcome back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Back to Radio Times and WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Even as parts of Pennsylvania begin to open up on Friday, many of us in the Delaware Valley will still be sheltering in place, and so perhaps the boredom and stress continue. For the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking about a really cool way to de-stress, a connection with nature that doesn't have to involve close interaction with other humans or even, you know, a trip outside the home. In a pinch, a good window can be used for bird watching. Questions or comments? Send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Holly Merker is a birding instructor and professional bird guide and co-founder of Ornithotherapy.com, and she joins us now for Radio Times. Great to have you with us, Holly.
Hi, Mary. Thank you for having me on this morning.
So, Holly, many of us, even during normal times, don't really listen to what's around us because daily life is just so busy and absorbing, and I'm right there with that. But it's been shown that taking the time to watch and learn about birds can actually be good for physical and mental health. Tell us about this.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we connect to nature, we know that that experience de-stresses us and helps us focus in sort of a mindful way. So observing other animals around us allows us to connect. And when we're doing that, we can lower our cortisol rate. So there have been studies now that have been proving that even just a 20-minute little bit of time outdoors can allow you to kind of de-stress and connect. And this lowers cortisol levels. So cortisol is the stress hormone. And this, when you are feeling extra stressed, you can reconnect with nature and get out there and start feeling soothed and relaxed. And this is really fantastic using birds because birds are so accessible to us. They're right outside our door. They're always there for us. And right now with spring, right at the birds are singing. You can hear the dawn chorus every morning. It's just fantastic.
So who do we tend to hear first thing in the morning in early May?
So yeah, that dawn chorus that I just mentioned. So the dawn chorus is comprised of American robins, many of them out there singing overlapping calls. Also, northern cardinals, Carolina wrens, song sparrows, just so robust in song right now. So they're out there singing. They're announcing their territory. They're also attracting mates, and it's just glorious.
Is it
nature's
tough?
Nature's orchestra.
Is it hard to learn to distinguish birdsong?
So it can be, and that's the challenge. But you know what? You don't have to benefit from not knowing what you're hearing. Just listening to the soundtrack that nature provides us, it can just really focus us and start having the ability. Like, for example, we use music therapy to kind of recenter ourselves and bring us to a common ground as far as our anxiety and mood. And birdsong can do the same thing. It can lower your blood pressure and help you relax.
Let's talk about the basics of learning to identify birds. I'm guessing it takes patience, silence, maybe a good book or a website. What do we need?
Okay, so learning how to identify birds, it can be challenging at times, and it can be overwhelming. So I always like to tell everybody to set your goal like pretty low. So challenge yourself to learn just a couple birds at a time. And I would recommend resources. There are fabulous resources online available right now that are free and open to everybody. Cornell Lab of Ornithology has the Merlin ID Bird app, which is really fantastic, a free download. But if you aren't going to use your smartphone or tablet, a lot of resources online, allaboutbirds.com. Other resources provided through Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And, of course, there are many different local bird clubs available in the Delaware Valley region and beyond where you can connect with other birders who can take you out on a bird walk and teach you how to look at birds and also how to learn how to interpret the song.
And fortunately, I'm sure it's probably fairly easy to social distance when you're out on one of these walks.
Yeah, so right now most of the bird clubs have suspended their walks. But at this time, the best part about learning birds is you can do it right outside your door and window. So again, birds are so charismatic, and right now they're so busy. They're returning from their long winters spent in Central and South America. They're coming back into our region, and they're singing, they're building nests, and they're actively feeding, constantly getting ready for their next life journey. Some of them are just stopping through. And, you know, we may only see them for a couple of days each spring. So it's really exciting because this is, in some senses, being isolated and sheltering in place has been a difficult journey for a lot of us. But at the same time, nature is awakening right outside our door. And really, nature's like the greatest show on earth. So getting out there and enjoying it. Well, it just couldn't be a better time, really.
If you were going to choose a couple of migratory birds for a starter to watch for, which would you choose?
Okay, so migratory birds. Well, right now we have birds that are coming through our area and that are colorful and full of song. So birds that are entering into our region but are also probably going to stay are the wood thrush, which you can hear at wooded edges singing, beautiful songs, flute-like songs in the morning. Also coming through right now are Baltimore orioles, which are orange and black. And many people recognize that bird because of the baseball team in Maryland. Mm-hmm. But they're singing nice whistling songs. Also, I would say scarlet tanagers are a bright red bird with black wings and just a true gem if you could pick one out in a tree. And so those are some migratory birds that are going to stay here for a couple of weeks, if not staying for the summer. So some are just passing through, and others are also here for a while. Now, migratory birds, there are some that are warblers. Like, warblers are passing through right now, really good numbers. And every night, birds are migrating overhead and then dropping into our region, feasting on a meal before they get up and start moving to the next jaunt of their journey northward for where they'll be nesting. So There's many different types of warblers you can spot. They're harder to spot, though, without binoculars.
That was the question. Is it really a good idea to try, if you're going to invest in anything, in a good pair of binoculars?
Well, of course, binoculars really enhance your experience in a lot of ways because you're able to get a closer look and really study these birds, get to know them, get to know their personalities, and focus on how to identify them by looking at their size and shape. Now, we can do that with our eyes. And right now, like I was saying, it's a great time to be looking at birds because many of them are very busy, so they're giving us more opportunity to watch. But you don't need a fancy pair of binoculars. And binoculars these days, really good quality, are really good quality binoculars that can range from $200 or less or even $100 or less are available. And I would look for something that is waterproof and that feels good in your hands if you had the opportunity to try them ahead of time.
What's the best time of day to birdwatch?
So a lot of us feel that at this time of year, getting outside first thing in the morning at dawn's light, because of that dawn chorus that I mentioned, birds are busy. They've just either spent the night migrating, and so they're actively looking for food along the trees. And their food, a lot of these birds are, most of them are insectivores, meaning they eat insects for a living, and they're looking for things like caterpillars. So anywhere that they're are bright sunny edges first thing in the morning, because that warms up the caterpillars and other insects, gives these birds some really good opportunities to refuel, and they sit still a little longer for you to have the opportunity to watch them. So I would say morning is usually best this time of year, but you can get out at any time and watch birds, even right before the sun falls.
Okay.
Birds are still feeding.
Mm-hmm. We are taking calls, not calls, questions and comments to Radio Times at WHYY.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And Ambalia has a question. I am obsessed with these birds rebuilding a nest between me and my neighbor's porches. They take the brown ornamental grass from my garden and take it to fortify their nests. But how do they know to do this? And are these the same birds who have lived there before? So a little bit of information to go on. Not quite sure you can make an observation, Holly, but care to take a crack at it?
Sure. Okay. So what's probably going on here? First off, I would say that, yeah, it probably is the same birds that you're seeing recurring in your yard, maybe even year to year, because some birds can live several years. They're finding bits of grass. They know exactly, each bird knows exactly how to create its own nest. So they're finding fibers or materials that work for it. And that bird is carefully designing that nest, constructing it, and will end up laying eggs in there eventually, but they're going to be finding those materials and utilizing the same spaces each year. Or sometimes they will build nests, more than one nest in a year. And so obviously the habitat in between your yards works well for them. It provides safety probably and a good food resource.
What can we plant to attract birds?
Oh, there's all sorts of native plants that you can focus on. So I always recommend planting native plants, which means plants that would be in this region naturally. Even though there are a lot of beautiful plants that and trees that are from other areas, the native plants provide the native food, which are those insects and seeds that I was talking about before. So things like salvia would be very good in this area, and Other purple cone flowers, beautiful flowers that can not only provide you with a lot of pleasure, but when they go to seed head, Monarda or bee balm also ends up being a really good bird feeder, a natural bird feeder. So some people can't have bird feeders where they live, but instead if you plant some flowers that attract birds, either through seed heads or from the pollen, if you have pollinators like hummingbirds, it invites them into your landscape.
Holly Marker, COVID-19 is providing an opportunity for a unique experiment for scientists. How are birds responding to a, for the moment, quieter, less polluted world? Are you observing any differences in the location that you usually find yourself in? I think it's the Chester County area.
Yeah, that's right. So it's going to be an interesting season. So the cool thing I've noticed is that there are a lot more people engaging in nature than I've ever seen before. Okay, so whereas we don't have a lot of light pollution right now or even traffic, noise and distractions as much as we normally would, I'm seeing a lot of people outdoors. And so this is a good thing in a lot of ways because we have people interacting with nature in a new way, but also I haven't seen a whole lot of difference in bird activity myself yet, but I do think that some birds are going to be, some of the areas that have been closed are going to have a little more opportunity to set up shop for the nesting season and maybe place their nests in areas where they hadn't before, which would be a little bit more beneficial for them. But what I love to see, like I said, is the effect of people getting outdoors and engaging with nature in new ways. And hopefully that trend will continue.
It's estimated that 40% of the world's 10,000 bird species are in decline, according to the 2018 State of the World's Birds Report. Holly, tell us about the initiative called eBird, which is apparently helping conservationists make a real difference. How does it work?
Right. So eBird.org is a Cornell Lab of Ornithology database, which is where people like you and I can contribute our sightings of birds. We can census them and even in our own backyard. So this is what's called community or citizen science. And there are apps that you can use to submit these data. And it's telling us where birds are on the planet 24 hours a day across the globe. So now we can learn about what areas birds are utilizing in order to survive, and also where to find birds, where to go look for. If you want to see a scarlet tanager in your area, you can use eBird.org to figure out where other people have been seeing them and then better your chances.
And when it comes to forming policy, one of the cool things that's come out of eBird is that conservationists have apparently, for instance, on the West Coast, have convinced many farmers to rent habitat for the Pacific flyway over California. They flood their fields, which then helps replace the wetland habitat that's disappeared. So a really cool project to be involved with.
Absolutely.
How was the term ornithotherapy coined?
Okay, so ornithotherapy was first used in the 1970s in England, and it's connecting people again with nature. The benefits, so first off, ornithology is the term for studying birds, and then, of course, therapy, therapeutic value. So bird connecting people with birds and nature, bird watching is therapeutic. And as I was mentioning before, we now know, science proves, that being outdoors in nature and connecting and having those interactions really does facilitate mental and physical well-being. And so that term, ornithotherapy, is connecting, giving people the opportunity to get out and really connect, mindfully watching birds. So getting out and watching a bird and how it behaves, detaching your mind, allowing yourself to focus in the moment, and just be able to take it in. When we start distracting ourselves like that, that's when we start having those benefits, those health benefits of feeling better, de-stressing. Not only that, but if, you know, we all have this digital fatigue right now going on from the demands of our society. Yes, we do. So when we kind of go out and we start letting ourselves escape from that, it's like a mini vacation that we're taking. And we're going out and we're studying another living organism. Our mind starts separating from what was on our, you know, was weighing heavily on us. And we start being able to connect, and it starts the stress starts melting away from us. And I personally have used this myself for many years. I was formerly a cancer patient, and I feel that nature and birds were one of the frontline weapons in my own healing process. It gave me the opportunity to really detach from all the stress and the physical pain that I was going through at the time. And I strongly believe that anybody can use nature and birds especially to connect and have these same benefits.
It just sounds absolutely amazing. Well, we're just about out of time, unfortunately. But again, you've co-founded ornithotherapy.com with internationally acclaimed birder and author Richard Crossley of the Crossley ID Guide series. And we've got about 10 seconds left. There is a daily ornithotherapy challenge.
Yes, so I'm giving people opportunities on ways to connect with birds and nature. So if you go to ornithotherapy.com, or we have a very active Facebook group where I'm providing those challenges, you'll be able to do it yourself.
Okay, thank you, Holly Merker. What fun. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, Mary. Take care.
Holly Merker is co-founder of ornithotherapy.com. And remember, Radio Times is here for you on social media. Visit us at whyy.org. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you with us for Radio Times. Be well.